Hello, everybody. Andrew here with an introduction to what is a very special episode of the Palace of Glittering Delight. What you're about to hear was originally envisioned to be the first episode of a new podcast to be hosted by myself, Sean Engel, and Paul Spataro. It was to cover Firefly and to take the perspective of one ardent Whedon fan, myself, somebody who's slightly more ambivalent to Whedon's work, Sean, and somebody who's never seen Firefly at all, which would be Paul. However, shortly after this episode was recorded, Sean was taken ill and suddenly and very sadly passed away with only two episodes in the can. The current plan is to get back to this project at some point, possibly with Dr. Bill Robinson himself, who did appear on the second recording, joining us for each and every episode to keep that three-person dynamic. Until that happens, I very much hope you enjoy hearing Sean, Paul and myself discuss the pilot episode to Firefly, Serenity, not to be confused with the film of the same name, and hope once again that you enjoy hearing Sean's voice on another all-new podcast. Rest easy, pal. We still and will always miss you.
Time for some thrilling heroics, a brand new podcast on twotruefreaks.com. Keep flying, a Firefly podcast. We aim to do the impossible, cover every episode of Joss Whedon's science fiction space opera Western, and that makes us mighty. We found as fine a crew as ever populated the podcasting verse. I told them I had a job. They said yes. Didn't much care what it was. I'm Andrew Leyland. I fought for the independence. May have been the losing side. Not so sure it was the wrong one. I'm joined by a man far too pretty to die, Mr. Paul Spataro, and last but by no means least, a man with a mighty fine hat, Mr. Sean Engel. Hello!
Hey, how's it going?
It's tickety-boo. How are you two today?
I just love when you're tickety-boo.
I don't even know what that means.
I only know what it means because we've had this conversation before.
I must have been asleep for that conversation.
You were probably very much asleep.
I think that may have been a Facebook private message conversation. I think it may not have been actually allowed.
Oh, right. Okay. So fair enough. We were just chatting over Facebook. Well, in this inaugural episode, I have conned these two gentlemen into watching Firefly. One of whom has seen it before, one of whom has never watched it. See if you can guess which one. We'll leave that to the audience. Firefly was Joss Whedon's third series after Buffy and Angel and was the product of a number of different inspirations. First off was Michael Shara's novel The Killer Angels, chronicling the Battle of Gettysburg in the American Civil War. And Whedon wanted to follow them that lost the war, the people on the outskirts of civilization, eking out a living on the frontier. He decided to marry this to a science fiction framework with the idea of following a Han Solo-type character if he never actually met Obi-Wan and Luke in the canon. The first one we'll be looking at tonight is the pilot episode of the series, Serenity, written and directed by Joss Whedon. Unusually for a pilot, Fox didn't air this first. They aired it last and asked Whedon and writer Tim Minear to quickly come up with another episode that they would air first, which we'll be looking at next time. I've already said one of you didn't watch it before, but the one that did, which was Sean. So if you guessed Sean in the pool, well done. Did you watch this
one?
Come
and collect your winnings.
Yeah. We've not decided what those winnings are yet.
We have to go through the DemonsCorp bank to see if we can acquire some money to pay the winners.
All right. Okay. So they're not getting anything then?
No.
They should just submit their vouchers and then we'll take it from there.
Mm-hmm. They get this podcast for free.
That's true.
That's their prize.
And I think that's more than anyone could ever ask for.
I think so too. Did you watch this when it aired, Sean?
No, actually, I didn't. I might as well since we're talking about it, I might as well tell you. I'm approaching this as not really. I know you're a real fan of Joss Whedon stuff, and that you really enjoy it. I I kind of have this thing with Joss Whedon where I like his stuff, I like his writing, but it's hard for me sometimes to disconnect the person Joss Whedon from his material. Sometimes Joss Whedon gets under my skin, but most of the time his shows and his the stuff that he puts out is really rather entertaining. I never got into Buffy. I never got into Angel. I never got into Dollhouse. I only watched this, surprisingly, after I watched the Serenity movie, and I was so captured by the actual movie version that I went back and watched this and was really impressed with this. I haven't rewatched this since the original time that I watched it, so doing this show is kind of giving me a chance to look at the Firefly universe and look at the Firefly show again to see if it really holds up as well as it did when I first watched it. Joss Whedon's gone on, obviously, to do some big things with Marvel, helming the first two Avengers movies, working specifically on the new Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. show. And in general, I've really liked those movies. I think the Avengers movies were some of the best Marvel movies they put out. I have kind of gotten left behind on the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. show. The first season was okay. It had its ups and downs. The second season started out really good, but once Agent Carter hit, I was just so enamored of that that I really didn't catch on to the rest of the season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And I don't think it's necessarily because of Joss Whedon, but I just liked Agent Carter so much more. So I'm coming to this as not a extreme fan of Joss Whedon, but enjoying his stuff and enjoying this series.
I don't think Joss is overly involved with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
No, I think it's his brother, actually.
Yeah, I think it's his brother as well, yeah. I think it's produced by Mutant Enemy as part of Whedon's deal, but I don't think he himself is involved with it on a day-to-day basis at all. Beyond directing the pilot episode, I don't think he's been involved with the show much at all. It doesn't have that feel of a Whedon show. It has that feel of people trying to be Joss Whedon, which is the downfall of many shows that aren't produced by the man himself. He has been hugely influential on television. There's lots of little things. Even now, we'll be watching something, and I'll say to Angela, that's a Whedonism. That's from Buffy. And there is so much of Buffy that has informed what television has become. And I'm just talking about little lines of dialogue. Not so much being a phrase that has entered TV vernacular. That's from Buffy. And adding wise to the end of things is a Buffyism. So there's so many ways he's been influential on television without ever really having a smash hit TV series. Let's not forget, Buffy was on the WB. Doesn't take much to be a smash hit on the WB. This was cancelled after 13 episodes when it was on a major network. So he's not really had the level of success that his closest, I don't want to say superior, his closest, what's the word I'm looking for? The person closest to Whedon in the TV firmament at the minute, I would say, is J.J. Abrams.
Mm-hmm.
And Abrams and Whedon both represent to me the different sides of the television coin. Whedon tends to do stuff that is a little bit off-center, a little bit not perhaps as mainstream as Abrams' stuff, but has just enough mainstream appeal that get that there is a core audience that like it, but it will never really cross over into that massive mainstream appeal that Abrams shows has. Abrams has done Alias and Person of Interest and Lost, and pretty much all of them were mainstream hits, with the possible exception of Alias. And you can see the difference in their approach to the films as well. Whedon has inadvertently blundered into doing blockbusters. Abrams does blockbusters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the difference between the two. For me, Whedon is my preferred producer. I connect more with his characters and what he says in his work than I do with Abrams. But I'm not down on Abrams. I loved Alias. I love Person of Interest. I think Mission Impossible 3 is easily the best of the Mission Impossible films so far. The fifth one that's coming out may prove me wrong on that. But for me, Whedon is much more interesting as a writer in that he's not afraid to fail. And that's what I find interesting about him. There is nothing about this show that is mainstream in any way whatsoever. And the fact that he thought he could get away with it on a mainstream network is a constant surprise to me.
Yeah,
but we'll yeah, we'll get into more about Whedon versus other people and the tone of his shows as we go along, I think.
Yeah, I think the one thing that Whedon excels at is doing interesting characters. And this show is populated with some of the most interesting characters that you will find in television. And, you know, I come from that not having seen Buffy or Angel, because I'm certain that he set up this idea of these very interesting characters and giving them very these sort of arcs that, you know, would lead them to be these very unique characters. So I think that's one of the things that Whedon excels at, and you get to see these characters like this fleshed out in this series.
I think the characters in this are more fleshed out than Buffy from the get-go. Buffy's pilot, and I've got an episode of Palace Glitter and Delight, you can go back and listen to that, talking about the first season of Buffy. But Buffy's characters are all archetypes from the get-go, deliberately. He said he did that deliberately to bring people into the show. And from there, he fleshed them out a little bit more. I thought everyone in this pilot was interesting from the get-go, but Mal Reynolds is certainly one of my favourite television characters, even though I'm far more like Wash. I'm not as cool as Mal. But the other side of the spectrum, we've got Paul, who's never watched Firefly.
Came dragged kicking and screaming into this one.
Yeah, let's just peel behind the curtain, but this is all my fault. I was on holiday, and while I was swimming in the pool, minding my own business, I just suddenly got this inspirational idea that we are so far ahead with recording Deep Space Nine, and we keep making jokes in Listen to the Prophets, our Deep Space Nine podcast that you should go and listen to, twotruefreaks.com, that we, at the end of that, we've got all this list of shows that we're going to cover. And I was just minding my own business, swimming along, and I just suddenly thought, why are we waiting? This only ran for 13 episodes plus a film. We can do this in 7 recording sessions. So I immediately texted Paul and Sean and said, you can tell me to piss off if you want to, but why don't we do this every other recording session? And they both said, yeah, okay. And
then I said, piss off.
Yeah, yeah. Paul said piss off, but Sean said, okay. And immediately after they got in touch with me, and Paul said, you do know I've never seen this show, right? And that just made me more interested in doing it, because I think this is just such an interesting dynamic. You've got me, who is the Whedon fan. You've got Sean, who needs to be convinced on occasion. And then you've got Paul, who's never even seen it. And I think that's an interesting dynamic for a show. In 15 episodes or so, I may be proved wrong, but we'll see.
I'll give you, you know, my background a little bit on it is I am not very well versed in the Whedonverse, probably even less so than Sean. And I know with Buffy, I had heard wonderful things about it for years. And when I did try to do a binge watching of it, for some reason, I only got like 2 or 3 episodes in, and then I got derailed, not because I disliked it, but just because, you know, life got into the way. So I never did get around to finishing that off. The only show that I have watched is Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which, as we said, is not necessarily so much a Joss Whedon-influenced show. And my experience with it is very, very similar to Sean's. As far as Firefly goes, I've heard tremendous things over the years about it, and it is only 13 episodes. And you would think, you know, it's an easy candidate to binge watch. And I've actually had access to it for a while, and I've been wanting to watch it, but I've never had anything to kind of just push me over to the edge to actually do it. So I'm happy to have this opportunity. I'm thinking, as I was watching the first episode, I'm thinking my only negative right now on it is I feel, because I've heard so much about it, that I've already been influenced a little bit, and I want to like it a lot. Instead of just giving it a fair shake as somebody who never saw it and just came across it on TV and started to watch it, I actually have the desire to like this show. Now, in my experience, sometimes that works in your favor and sometimes that works against you. Sometimes it makes you give something a shot that you wouldn't, and stick with something a little longer than you might have until you finally get to that point where it starts bearing fruit. And other times you watch something that people raved about and ultimately you say, yeah, I don't get what all the buzz was. So that's where we have to see what's going to happen with this one. I'll peel back the curtain or cut right to the chase on it. So far, one two-part episode in, so good.
Yeah, it does kind of – there is that kind of trepidation you can come across where people have lauded this show for so long and said, this show is great, this show is great, that it does kind of lead you to feel that if you do watch it and don't like it as much as so many other people do, that you're, it is sort of setting it up for failure. It is kind of that, what is the name of the film? The Orson Welles film
with
Rosebud. Yeah, Citizen Kane. Well, it's early in the morning. It's the sort of that Citizen Kane effect that everyone says this is the greatest film ever made, and they beg you to watch it, and you watch it and you go, okay, I didn't get as much out of it as this person did, and I don't see why this is supposedly the greatest film ever made. And there is that trap where the plaudits that this show has been given over time could lead it to be, could lead you down that road that would make you think that it's not going to turn out to be as good as people have said. Hopefully that won't be the case.
The movie example for that for me was Forrest Gump. I remember that movie came out and people were raving, oh, this is so great, you know, and all just couldn't be more positive in the reviews. And then when I saw it, I said, yeah, it's all right, but I don't really see what all the fuss is about.
Yeah, I thought a lot about Forrest Gump as well.
Yeah, and there is always...
Watched it once, don't feel the need to watch it again.
And there's always... And then you have movies like Citizen Kane, since you brought it up. My thoughts on Citizen Kane were, I can watch that movie, and it does pull me into the plot a little bit, but not quite enough. And I can watch it, and I find myself looking at the technical aspects, you know, the cinematography and the angles and the editing and things like that, and I can see that it's masterful. But it lacks a little bit in entertainment. And when I'm rating movies, entertainment is a big factor in that. Mm-hmm. So it's why we had a whole string conversation on Facebook about that. Somebody posted, I think it was the top 50 movies of all time or top 100 movies of all time. And we were debating the input of certain movies. And ultimately, that's what I came down to is, entertainment value is a big factor for me when I rank. If I'm ranking my top 10 of all time, they have to not only be technically well made, but they have to be entertaining too. So Citizen Kane doesn't make my top 10 of all time because I don't think it's that entertaining.
Mm-hmm. And I've never seen it.
Spoilers, Rosebud's a sled.
All right, Bruce Willis is dead.
Yeah.
He's a girl. All of that.
Tony Perkins is his own mother.
Yeah.
That's a massive twist. All right, so I'll do the synopsis and then we can talk about the pilot episode.
Sounds
rather cool. Confusingly, the pilot episode is called Serenity, so don't get it mixed up with the film that followed the series. As I've said, it was written and directed by Joss Whedon. I have stolen the synopsis from Wikipedia. The synopsis: in 2511, Sergeant Mal Reynolds and Corporal Zoe Elaine fight in the Battle of Serenity Valley during the Unification War. Without Earth support, the Browncoats are eventually defeated and massacred by the Alliance. 6 years later, Mal is the captain of his own transport ship, an older model Firefly-class vessel he named Serenity, and Zoe is his second in command. The rest of the ship's crew consists of Wash, who is the pilot, and also Zoe's husband, Kaylee, the engineer, and Jane Cobb, the gun for hire. Inara, a companion who rents one of Serenity's two shuttles, normally travels with them, but she's currently away from the ship on business. While the crew are illegally salvaging some crates off an abandoned spaceship, they are discovered by an Alliance cruiser. To escape capture, they deploy a decoy distress beacon. The Alliance cruiser falls for the diversion, but broadcasts a bulletin that a Firefly-class ship is carrying stolen Alliance goods. The crew of Serenity travel to Persephone, where they intend to deliver the stolen goods to Badger, the small-time gang leader who hired them for the heist. When they meet with Badger, he reneges on the deal, partly because he's worried about the Alliance broadcast on the rogue Firefly, and partly because he doesn't like the way Mal looks down on him. Mal decides to try selling the cargo to Patience, an old business associate who lives on Whitefall. Zoe has misgivings about the plan, since Patience once shot Mal, but Mal is desperate to get rid of the hot cargo and bears no grudge, since he was shot in a perfectly legitimate conflict of interest. The crew joins up with Inara and picks up passengers to provide some supplemental income. The new passengers are a preacher named Shepherd Buck, a bumbling man named Dobson, and a wealthy doctor named Simon Tam, who brings on board a mysterious large crate. En route to Whitefall, Wash discovers that someone on board sent a message hailing the nearest Alliance cruiser. Suspecting that Simon is the mole, Mal confronts him only to discover that Dobson is the Fed. Dobson surprises Mal by telling him it is Simon he's here to arrest, not Mal. Later, whilst Dobson attempts to arrest Simon, he shoots Kaylee in the stomach before being overpowered by Book, who is surprisingly good at hand-to-hand combat for a Shepherd. When the Alliance cruiser orders them to dock for prisoner transfer, Simon threatens not to treat Kaylee if Serenity does not flee. Torn between the threat of capture and Kaylee's safety, Mal reluctantly agrees after being prodded by Inara to do so and flees from the Alliance ship. Mal goes to the cargo bay, opens Simon's mysterious crate, and is surprised to find a young woman inside in cryonic sleep. The woman in the crate is revealed to be River Tam, Simon's sister. Simon explains that his sister was a brilliant child who was sent away to an elite Alliance academy when she was 14. After River sent him an encoded letter for help, he discovered the Alliance was torturing and experimenting on students at the academy. Simon left his job as a successful trauma surgeon to rescue her from the Alliance and is on the run trying to protect her from them. Mal decides to proceed to Whitefall as planned, dropping off both the goods and the Tam siblings. Dobson has been tied up out of the way. Mal tells Jane to interrogate Dobson to find out what he told the Alliance. Once Jane finds out that the Alliance knows nothing, Dobson tries to bribe him. He also told Jane that his first name is Lawrence. Soon after, they discover that a Reaver ship is approaching. Zoe explains to Simon that if they take the ship, they'll rape us to death, eat our flesh, and sew our skins to our clothing. And if we're very, very lucky, they'll do it in that order. Luckily, the Reaver ship passes by without incidents. Serenity lands on Whitefall, and Mal proposes to make the deal. Distrustful of Patience, he sends Jane to take a sniper position in the hills, whilst he and Zoe walk out to meet Patience and her henchmen in a deserted valley. Mal gives Patience a sample of the cargo, which turns out to be nutritional ammunition bars, each one of which can feed an entire family for a month. Patience tries to kill them so she can take the cargo without paying, but Mal and Zoe, with the help of Jane, dispatch Patience and her gang, taking the money they were promised. Although one of Patience's men shot Mal's arm, ripping a hole on his sleeve coat. Jane then joins the others, having been contacted by Wash with the bad news. The Reavers followed them to Whitefall. Meanwhile, back on the ship, Dobson escapes, knocking out Book and grabbing River. Simon inexpertly attacks Dobson, but after they scuffle, Dobson ends up with River grabbed by an arm and pointing a gun at her head. Mal arrives and shoots Dobson, dumping his body off the ship as they start to take off, the Reavers hot on their tail. Mal orders Inara, Simon and River to Inara's shuttle, preparing them to escape if the ship is boarded by the Reavers. Jane carries the still convalescing Kaylee to the engine room, and Book offers to help them. With Jane and Book carrying out Kaylee's instructions, Wash is able to pull off a crazy Ivan, and Serenity escapes. Jane tells Mal that they should dump the siblings, since Dobson had told him during the interrogation that the Alliance will keep coming after River. Mal, suspecting that Dobson tried to make a deal with Jane, asks why he didn't turn. Jane responds that the money wasn't good enough. Mal asks what happened when it is. Jane says, "That'll be an interesting day." Jane leaves as Simon enters. Mal suggests to Simon that he and River might be safer on the move than hiding in one place, and points out that Serenity is always moving and in need of a medic. Simon accepts the position. The end. As usual with Wikipedia, that was a rather dry synopsis, wasn't it?
I thought you did a good job of reading it. When I read a synopsis that long, I'm afraid at the end I sound like Ferris Bueller's teacher. Or even worse.
Or Charlie Brown.
Even worse, Bill doing a con review.
But, no, that
but
was...
I think you maintained your enthusiasm as you read it, which is impressive.
Well, it's not really difficult to maintain your enthusiasm discussing this show. I think this is a really good pilot, and I'm surprised that Fox decided not to use this as the pilot episode, because it does such a great job of setting up all these characters and without really having to tell you all that much about them, letting the characters' actions show what their motivations are and what kind of characters they are. This is a really good example of actors and I guess the screenwriters as well showing what the characters are like without you having to come out and tell them about them, without having a bunch of dialogue saying, "Well, I was in this battle and I lost my faith in humanity and God and, you know, the government and all this, and this is why I'm doing this." They don't come out and do that. They allow it to be, they allow the viewers to gather that from the actions of the characters. And I really appreciate that, because so often shows just tend to spell that out for you through dialogue, and you don't get that here. So this is what makes this a significantly better show than a lot of shows on the air right now.
But I think your explanation is exactly why they didn't want to go with that. I agree with you that it was very well done, but I think you need to have the motivation to sit and watch it and let these characters develop. And with a brand new show that has never been on before, with a genre that's kind of a little off the beaten path here as the sci-fi Western, I could see where Fox's executives would have some fear that people wouldn't give it a chance and wouldn't let the characters have the time to show who they are. It was a viewing by me that actually took a little effort to focus on it and figure out who was who. So I could see where they would have some fear on a pilot episode that maybe people wouldn't stick with it. Now, once you do stick with it, I think it proves to be well worth it. But I could see where people who don't otherwise have a reason to might just say, I'm not going to be bothered with this. You know, it's a day and age, I know, with me personally, where a lot of times when I'm watching TV, I'm multitasking. And I think if you are multitasking as you're watching the show, you're probably going to miss out on a lot of that. And you're going to get about 25 minutes into it, and you're going to say, I don't know what's going on. And you may turn it off at that point. So I can understand their fears, even though ultimately they ended up with a very, very high quality pilot.
I think it's a brilliant pilot. I don't disagree with anything you've said. You can't multitask while you're watching this. I think that's a strength. I think Breaking Bad plays on the idea that you can't multitask while you're watching it. And maybe Firefly was just ahead of its time. I like that they don't spell out the story beats for you. At the beginning of the show, we clearly see Mal Kiss across. He's clearly a religious man. So what happened to him that later on in the episode, when Buck asks him if he minds if they say grace, he says only as long as you don't say it aloud. You know, what has damaged this man so much that he's gone the complete opposite direction? I like that the costumes tell you who the characters are. You can look at pictures of each one of those and know exactly what they are just from what they were. And you could tell that Jane's the mercenary. You could tell that Buck's the shepherd. You could tell that Mal's the lead by what they were in. And it's one of the best examples of actors and characters and show that I can think of in recent times. Every single person in this is exquisitely cast, which is why it's interesting to learn that Inara was originally a different actress and they recast it and refilmed certain scenes, because you can't now imagine this ensemble not being together. I thought it was a masterful pilot for all the reasons you've just said Fox probably didn't like it. And in addition to the reasons that you gave, which are all pretty much what they said, they thought Mal was too dour as a lead. And as we go into the series, they do lighten him up slightly. But he's still snarky and he's still funny and he's still damaged goods, which is the point of the character.
I thought the moment when Mal won me over, the moment where I said this is a character I'm going to like, was when he confronted Jane at the dinner table. Now, here's a character who he clearly will not be able to physically compete with as far as in a fight. But first of all, he doesn't hesitate to call him out and exercise his command as the captain. But also you get the feeling that even though he can't physically battle this guy, somehow he would win if they had to fight. And that was the point where I said, okay, this is a character I'm going to enjoy watching for 13 episodes. And I'm going to regret the fact that there aren't 100 episodes.
It is. The cancellation is a shame, but for now, let's just revel in what we've got. I think it's a brilliant pilot. I love that it takes its time to unfold. I love that it takes its time to set up the characters. I love that they're not all in place at the beginning. As you go through the show, they add a couple more characters that will become regulars. And the thing about it as a pilot, the thing that lets it down, I think, is having an opening credit sequence that is the opening credits of the series. I think if they'd have treated this as a pilot film and done what a lot of pilot films do in that they don't have the standard opening credit sequence, it would have been more as a surprise, because there's no doubt in your mind, because she's in the opening credits, that Kaylee's not going to die. Whereas if they hadn't had that opening title sequence, this being a Joss Whedon show, you would have been, well, maybe they'll kill her. Maybe she will actually die. And you wouldn't have known that Book and Simon and River would be on the ship. Having the title sequences with the clips from future episodes, I think, damages this as a pilot, because it's not quite as surprising as it should be. But in every other respect, I think it's brilliant. And it doesn't look cheap over a decade later. Although the Battle of Serenity Valley at the beginning is shot all in darkness, so they can get away with not having many people there.
Yeah, I did notice, and they could also get away with sets a little easier that way.
Yeah. Well, it's filmed at Lake Los Angeles, so it was filmed on location. But you're right, it does look occasionally like Star Trek planets.
It reminded me of some of the DS9 battle scenes that we're going to get to in a couple of seasons.
Yeah, whether or not they did some pickups on stage, I don't know. But it was filmed on location, but it did look remarkably stagey for something that was filmed on location. But for me, that was the only bit of it where I felt it showed its budget restrictions. I thought the rest of it held up over a decade later. And you can see how influential it was on Battlestar Galactica.
Oh, definitely. I think one of the things that Firefly innovated was the sort of, I guess what you'd call the man in space with the camera focus for the ships, where you'd get this sort of image of there's some guy in a spacesuit just out there in space who's filming the ship going by. And it's not the standard long shot where it's a very static shot. You get these zooms and these quick cuts that gives it a more frenetic feel. And Battlestar Galactica would definitely take advantage of that in the show. But I think Firefly was probably the first show to originate it. And it gives it a very different – it gives it a more gritty, a more – I guess a more realistic feel than your typical Star Trek, where you're seeing these ships move in slowly and pass by. I like the use of that sort of effect throughout the show.
I mean, let's give shout out to Space Above and Beyond, which also did that as well.
That's true.
So there is a little bit of Space Above and Beyond in both this and Galactica. But Space Above and Beyond special effects are all in space. This does atmosphere, and therefore they have to do the texture of the ground as well, which maybe they couldn't do when Space Above and Beyond was on the Earth. I don't know how advanced computer CG was at that point. But I thought this held up remarkably well, considering it's now over a decade old.
Oh, I didn't think the special effects suffered at all for a 10-year age gap. Interestingly, like with the pilot, is I did not feel that we had a point of view character. I didn't feel that there was anybody who we were viewing this through their eyes. The closest thing I would say is maybe the Doctor, but I think that's one of the things that caused you to have to really focus on it to kind of get what was going on. I think had they given you a point of view character, it might have brought you through it more easily. Of course, that would have led you to exactly the things that we're praising it for not doing. That would have led you to probably having scenes of exposition where he's having the characters explained to him or whatever. Again, it took a little bit more effort to watch this. But I think it paid off. I think it rewarded that effort. But, you know, other pilots, I'm comparing it to other shows that I've enjoyed over the years. And Lost, for example, the pilot pulled me in immediately. You know, you were just gripped. The second Jack's eye opened up on the beach, you were just pulled in and you're watching the show. And it didn't really take any effort to get into it. Breaking Bad opens up with an expositional scene of Walter White explaining what went on, you know, because then it goes into flashback mode. And it pulled me right in. This show, as I said, if we weren't doing this the way we are, I could see myself sitting on the couch and kind of looking at the newspaper and having the show on in the background and having gone half an hour into it and saying, I don't know what's going on, and just flip to a ball game or something, which is a bad reflection on me. I'm not defending that in any way. I think that's a character flaw, you know, not being able to put myself into a more intelligent show and tell you that I would totally buy into it without having some sort of an assurance that it was going to pay off for me. And that's what I had with this. I had an assurance that it was going to pay off for me. I had everybody telling me that, that it would pay off. And if nothing else, I had committed to doing this show with you guys. So I knew I was going to give it the shot that, you know, that it deserved, but it did pay off. And that's a huge plus.
Do we think that that's one of the things that might have been the downfall of the show, why it did only go one season, was because it didn't have that sort of instant connection that you got from those shows like Lost, where you actually had to pay more attention to the show to get all the goodness out of it, rather than just these sort of flashy shows that you can watch and not have to put as much effort into trying to get at things out of it? Do you think that's why it may not have succeeded initially as well as other shows did?
That's my first instinct on it. Now, I mean, I think we're selling Lost short to say that it's a show you didn't have to pay attention to, but I do think it had a little bit more of a hook in the pilot to get you focused on it before you did have to invest yourself as much. Hmm. But I've only watched one two-part episode so far. So I can't speak as the show went on. I would like to think, and I'm sure Joss Whedon was hoping, that the people who did invest the time in that pilot were going to create a buzz and a word of mouth to make the people who didn't give it the chance to go back and give it the time it deserves. And I guess that really didn't happen.
I think it's a conversation we may be able to have better after we've watched the next episode, which was written over a weekend to Fox's specific notes of what they wanted from the pilot. So until we see the train job, I don't think you can really see, well, what is it that Fox wanted from it that this didn't give them? But it goes into what we were talking about earlier about the difference between Abrams and Whedon, who are probably the two most prominent television/film producers currently working, that Lost gets you straight away. It's fast paced, it's frenetic, it's action packed. This is more character based. And I think maybe that's why I prefer this to Lost, because if the characters are engaging, and they are in this almost from the get go, you'll forgive them bad episodes a lot easier than Lost, which ultimately became about the mystery rather than about the characters. And ultimately, I think that was that show's downfall, that by the time we got to season 6, I didn't care anymore.
I would tend to agree with you on that.
I would have liked to have got to have season 6 and see if I still did care. And I do think something that we will have to talk about when we get to the end is the fact that it only lasted 15 years, why it has such a rabid following, is it never got the chance to be crap. There is something to be said for a quick burst in and done.
But you're definitely, if you're writing a show for Paul Spataro, you definitely are hitting the formula for success when you're combining science fiction, Western, and character-based.
You and me both.
Put those three together, I mean, that's a good formula as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and I just love the feel of this. I love the dialogue. I love that it's not cookie-cutter dialogue that you can transpose to any other show. It would only work in the context of this. And it's delivered by actors who are invested in it and get it. And I love the look of it. I love that it's all dusty backwater places. Nowhere shiny in this, ironically, apart from Alliance worlds. Alliance worlds are shiny. Alliance ships are shiny. Alliance uniforms are pristine and neat. All these people that we're following this show are us. They're the little people who are just trying to eke out a living on a day-to-day basis, doing whatever they can do to survive in the daily life. I love the look of it. Everyone wears clothes. Jane wears t-shirts and combat trousers. You know, there are no science fiction-y clothes, but at the same time, they don't look like they could exist now, even though you could possibly wear that and get away with it and no one would bat an eyelid at you. And it's just, he's put a lot of thought into the world building of it in the same way that the original Star Wars did. And that you get it not through exposition, not through people explaining to you how it came about, but by what's on screen. You get all of that just by watching the show. I think it's masterfully thought through and masterfully put together. And I do think it's a shame that they didn't air this first to see if it would build an audience. Because it's clear from the beginning the network didn't have faith in it, based on their notes about the pilot and what they made them do next. Because, like Paul says, you have to pay attention to this. But ultimately, you're rewarded for paying attention to it. And everything works in it. And I know Luke Giaconetti's emailed me about Firefly, and he considers it just a massive ripoff of some anime thing. And he's right. It probably is. But there's an awful lot of Western shows that are ripoff of Japanese shows. Doesn't make them bad shows.
Well, The Magnificent Seven is one of my favorite movies of all time.
The Magnificent Seven is also one of my favorite movies of all time. So if you put The Magnificent Seven with Star Wars, I'm tuning in to begin with. And this is what if Raylan Givens was on a spaceship. And that's probably why I love it so much. But there's individual moments in this that just pay off so much better than the overall plot and the overall arc. The bit at the beginning where Kaylee says to Mal when they land on Persephone, we need a chamber coil or a reactor coil or something. The one we've got's not in great condition. And Mal's like, we've not got money for stuff like that. Keep her in the air. Pay attention to that. That will pay off in a few episodes' time. He should have listened to Kaylee. And Kaylee's joy at the strawberry, implying that on the frontier worlds, they don't get a lot of real fruit. And just lots of little moments like that make it worthwhile. And there isn't a single character in this that can't support an episode. Whereas you do get in Deep Space Nine, there are characters you don't care about. And the minute you learn that episode's about them, you're like, oh, dear God. The minute you get a Deanna Troi episode in Next Gen, nobody cared.
Yeah, and that's what we'll see later on in the series. We'll see episodes about each of the individual characters. In fact, one of my favorite episodes is about the most sort of despicable character on the show is Jane. And you find out that even though this guy who's basically... he's the Guy Gardner of the Serenity series. He is the a-hole of this series. You know, he speaks out of turn. He makes crude and lewd jokes. He is a gun for hire. But you find out later in the series that he's practically worshipped on this one planet for doing this one thing. So you get all this setup, and you get these characterizations that make you feel that this is going to be just, oh, Jane's going to be the stereotypical asshole character. But Whedon doesn't allow it to just stop there. He layers these characters. And in this opening pilot, you get such a great look into all of these characters that you want to learn more about them. It's really masterfully done by Whedon. And I honestly, if this is the kind of stuff that he does for like Buffy and Angel and the rest of his shows, I want to start checking them out, because I need to start checking them out when I get time.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you. And I don't have the I was going to say I don't have the advantage of knowing what's coming, but I think I have the advantage of not knowing what's coming.
No, that's why when I found out you'd never seen it, that made me want to do it more.
And you know, there's I remember, well, you know, like when you talk, Sean, about not having seen Breaking Bad, I think, oh, I'm jealous of you because you get to sit and watch this whole show. So I feel like right now you guys are sitting there saying that you're jealous of me because I get to watch it. Mm-hmm. So I have to enjoy that. I have to – and I think that was part of the reason, you know, having that attitude was part of the reason why I did feel like – let me sit and really pay attention to this as I'm watching. Let me give this a fair shot, because everything I hear from everybody who watched this show is telling me it's going to pay off and I'm going to enjoy it. So that's the one aspect of it, though, that I can't say what would have happened if I was just sitting on a Monday night and this show came on and I gave it a shot. I don't know if I would have lost interest or not. I'm glad I didn't. I'm glad. I would really be pissed at myself right now if I was sitting here saying, yeah, I was the guy who did turn it off that day.
Right. What do you think about the basic premise of it? That Mal was fighting on the side of the Independents. The Independents lost. The Alliance is now in charge. Because at no point in the series, other than the River story, as that plays out, the Alliance aren't portrayed as actual bad guys. They're not the Empire. They're the government. And you can like or dislike your government. You can think that governments are a pain in the ass and we don't need them, or you can actively support them. But in this show, that's what they're played as. And Mal has no choice but to accept the way things are, even though he fought against them. What do you think of that premise?
Yeah, you're not given really a feeling for what the basis of the conflict is. Basically you're being given the government, you know, basically the big bad against the rebels, but you're not told why they're rebelling, what they're rebelling against.
And I just want to interrupt there a second. Sorry.
I'm sorry?
I just want to interrupt a second and say big bad Buffy term.
Is that?
So going back to how influential he's been on television.
Okay.
But carry on, sorry.
I was unaware of that, actually. So it's influenced me without even knowing that it has. But it's interesting to take the perspective. It's like, okay, let's pick up after the Empire, after Return of the Jedi, only the rebels lost. And that's an interesting premise in and of itself. And I would think that if the show was given time, I don't know over the course of time that we have, but I would think if it was given time, you would eventually learn a little bit about what the nature of the conflict was and why there are people rebelling against this particular government. But I'm fine with it being left as a nebulous, we don't know, we just know that this conflict existed. That really, you know, that's almost a MacGuffin kind of situation. You don't really have to know why they're fighting necessarily. But if you're going to have, you know, 100 hours of drama on it, maybe eventually you would find out. One thing that kind of left me a little, not necessarily scratching my head, but just kind of wondering, and I wonder if they might have gone into flashback mode at some point, was how do you get from that opening scene to where we pick up however many years later? Was it 6 years later?
Yeah, 6 years later.
It almost appears at the end of that opening scene that they're going to be taken prisoner as failed rebels, but I'm guessing that didn't happen. And I'd be interested in knowing, you know, how they did progress to get to that point. How did they escape? And I also liked in that opening scene how, you know, Mal is doing his best to motivate his people and saying, you know, this isn't going to happen. We're too pretty to lose or whatever.
And then they lose.
And the guy who he's talking to gets shot with a laser and he's gone. So he's not infallible by any stretch of the imagination.
No, I like the opening. It's tonally quite different from the rest of the episode, but deliberately so, because it's setting up that Mal and Zoe have this relationship that she doesn't even have with her husband, and her husband can't even understand the relationship that they have, which felt very realistic to me for people that have served together in that kind of conflict. So Zoe's relationship with Mal and Zoe's relationship with her husband, Wash, is very interesting and played up throughout the series. But Wash is never jealous of Mal in that way.
They start off with him, you know, doing the dinosaur fight, which I found to be engaging in and of itself.
If there's any character that's our way in, it's Wash.
But they don't give you enough from his perspective for him to become your point of view character either.
Yeah, and there's
no, I agree. There isn't one in this. In fact, if a story is about a character undergoing an arc or a change, who is this about? Then it's Simon's story. Then the character who actually changes throughout the course of this episode is Simon.
Right. That's what I had said. I think he's the closest thing we have to a point of view character in this episode, because he's also coming in. He's basically coming in where we're coming in, and meeting these people.
But also, with the character of Jane, Sean's just said he's the Guy Gardner of the show. But the scene where Kaylee's being operated on, he's outside the infirmary just rocking backwards and forward on his haunches. He clearly cares about Kaylee.
And that's one of the great things about the show. Even though these people are antagonistic towards each other, you know, you've got Mal and Inara, you know, Mal basically calling her a whore. But then by the end of the episode, he's incredibly concerned that these Reavers are going to take over the ship, and he wants to make sure that she's off the ship for their safety. You can feel that they really get the idea of family in this disparate group of people together, and that's one of the things that really works for me. you get the scene, like you said, you've got the scene with Jane looking inside the window as Kaylee's being operated on, and you get these secondary characters of Simon and River and Book coming on to ship, and what they're going to do to add or enhance this sort of family feel. And that's one of the really interesting things about this, is that these disparate groups of people come together, and they shouldn't work together, but they do because.
Which is now Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I guess you could kind of relate it to Guardians of the Galaxy, but I think
the familial relationship with these people seems like that to me. The way that they put it together in the movie, as far as the relationship of these characters, that's the way it feels here. And I mean that as a positive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, there is a Guardians vibe to it and how they all get along. But then even with that, you've got that Jane clearly cares about Kaylee, so why does he make that awful joke to her at the dinner table? That Mal ultimately banishes him for.
But because he's, he's too rough around the edges. He can care, but he can't smooth himself out.
He can't articulate that.
Well, and you kind of get from the beginning of the show that Jane is the stereotypical high school jock who has absolutely no filter whatsoever. So he's the kind of guy who's going to say something because he finds it amusing, regardless of whether or not it's actually should be said in polite conversation. He is total id, essentially. So he can allow that kind of thing to happen. And
that brings to mind to me the scene in Guardians when Drax is trying to articulate how he feels. The green whore is now my friend. I mean, Joss Whedon has obviously had an influence over the Marvel films. Who knows if he even, kind of helped him along. I don't know if he script doctored in any way, but I could see that being one of his lines.
We know he script doctored Thor 2.
Unfortunately, he script-docked X-Men.
Yeah, but that all got threw out apart from the one line about Wolverine being Cyclops being a dick.
His line was the, what happens to a toad in a lightning storm or whatever.
I know, but the punchline, it croaks, is funny, and they left that out of the film.
I'm just trying to think about that. Why did they leave that out of the film? That makes more sense than it does the same thing as everyone else. That's what
Weaver says. His punchline was, it croaks.
Oh, for the love.
And they changed his punchline. So that's why I don't accept that Whedon's at fault for that.
Okay, see, no, I was under the impression that he wrote the actual line they used, which made me think, guy's not as funny as he thinks he is.
I'm sure he wrote it croaks, but people can write in and tell us if we're wrong. Mark Shepard's Badger. If you watch Supernatural, you know who Mark Shepard is, because he's now in Supernatural every week, but he's also been in Doctor Who, just for Sean.
Now, who was he in Doctor Who? I'm trying to... Where did he show?
He's in the episode where they go back in time to Nixon.
Oh, okay.
And he's the CIA agent. It's a Matt Smith episode.
Oh, yeah. It's the one at sort of the beginning of the seventh season where, like, the impossible astronaut, maybe?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And because it's his dad who's playing the older version of him, who's William Morgan Shepard, who was in Star Trek VI and the Skid Man episode of Next Generation, and he's Blank Reg in Max Headroom.
Okay. So yeah, now I remember quite, who
He has quite a resume. I love Mark Shepard in this. I think Mark Shepard's very, very funny in it, especially because Mal does look down on him. You get the impression that Mal doesn't want to be dealing with people like Badger, but he doesn't really have much of a choice.
Well, the entire idea of the Serenity crew is they're trying to make their way in this world. They can't do it through legitimate means, so they've got to be kind of underhanded, but they don't want to be underhanded to the extent that they're doing evil things. They're kind of like, I don't know how to explain it. They're kind of like a polite mafia. They're not wanting to go out and kill people. They don't want to. They just want to make money, sort of skirting the law. And I think that's having it sort of that Western theme as well as that space-faring theme actually works really well with that sort of ideal.
Hmm. I think Badger's really good in it, and he's interesting. And they only take passengers on to make some supplementary income. So all of this could have been completely avoided if Badger had paid them. None of this would have happened.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only reason. Yeah, because that's the only reason they take Book and Dobson and Simon on.
Mm-hmm. The only thing that I can say negative about this. About this opening episode, or these opening two episodes, I guess, is that they really don't get much into the character of River. Now, that's pretty, I guess that's acceptable for them to do that, because she's just there as sort of kind of the sort of MacGuffin at the time. We'll get more into her character there, but I think her character was kind of diminished, that they didn't allow her character to be fleshed out in the same way that the rest of the characters on the show were. You got the backstory of her, or what her character was supposed to be like, by dialogue delivered by Simon throughout the show, you know, saying that she's this incredible level of brilliance and all of these things. And I would have liked to have had her character fleshed out in sort of the same way that the other characters on the show were. That would have worked better for me.
Yeah, but you will get that later, because essentially she's the David Banner to the Alliance's Jack McGee.
Mm-hmm.
She's the reason that Serenity has to keep moving. So they will get into that more as the series goes on. See, if this one is for introducing all the other characters, River is the main story arc for the first season, along with other little subplots that were cleverly introduced into this without signposting them. Like Paul was saying earlier on, why is a shepherd so good at hand-to-hand combat? What's that? What was that funny little vial that Inara had in her room? Why is she not working out with the other companions? Why is she on Firefly? Why is she on Serenity? So there's lots of little questions for them setting up to go the series, but River's the big main story arc for the season, and that will only pan out in the film, because the series was cancelled before they could actually follow through on any of it.
And I guess at this point, Summer Glau had, apparently she had been on Angel. But
she's in one episode of Angel as a ballet dancer. She's not real, because she was a ballet dancer.
Okay.
So whether or not,
but she wouldn't be a particularly well-known actress at this point.
No, it's her first job. It's her first job as an actress.
So watching this episode, I don't think you'd necessarily, you know, watching it at least when it came out, I don't think you'd necessarily see her and think, okay, she's going to be a significant character. If anything, she's presented in this as being a fairly minor character, and that her brother is going to be the significant character, and she's just his reason for being. So, you know, I keep trying to put it in perspective of when this episode came out, and I don't necessarily think I would have felt any kind of void from the fact that they didn't focus on her yet. I think, you know, knowing the level of fame she reached, or she has reached, I could see people saying, well, how come you haven't, you know, explored that yet? But when this was a new episode, I don't think that would have been a glaring fault at all. And again, and it's kind of sad that we have to do it with this perspective, but knowing it only went a few episodes, gives a different perspective to it. Whereas if you were creating this show and you're thinking, well, I'd like to go 7 seasons, you know, 24 episodes a season, or 20 episodes a season, or whatever, you're thinking to yourself, I have to keep some things in reserve, because, you know, I don't want to shoot out all my ammo in the first episode and then start looking for filler episodes, because I don't know where to go from there. So I don't know that, you know, I don't know that I have any real criticism of the fact that they didn't explore her further.
Yeah, because we know that she will get explored. And it's one of the things about every single one of this cast has gone on to have quite solid careers. The only one who was known, I think, was probably Shepherd Book. Yeah. Ron Glass, who was in, what was he in?
Barney Miller.
And obviously Adam Baldwin had quite a successful career before Firefly. Hannah's continued to have a successful career after Firefly, but I primarily remember him from being in Independence Day.
See, I remember him from, what's that movie? My Bodyguard. I think that was the first movie he was in with Chris Makepeace and Matt Dillon, where he played the bodyguard of Chris Makepeace and, you know, beat up Matt Dillon's bodyguard at the end. It was a good movie from like the early 1980s. I don't know if anyone saw it. It was in heavy rotation
with the
on
movie,
HBO.
But I don't think I've ever seen it.
It was on heavy rotation on HBO when I was a kid.
See, everyone forgets now this was Nathan Fillion's first lead role.
Yeah, this was pretty much the role that, you know, cemented him in as a major charismatic actor. I mean, this was the role that essentially ascended him to sort of geek godhood almost. You know, now everyone's like, oh, he should have been Green Lantern, and, you know, Castle was spun out of this. And so, yeah, it's impressive to see him starting out here and looking, you know, forward on his character, how big he's become because of this show.
Now, watching this episode, and I couldn't help but compare it in some ways to DS9. And I'm comparing it in my mind to the pilot of that. And this show appears to me, and again, I've only seen this episode, but this show appears to me to have a much greater feel for these are who our characters are and this is where they're going to go, as opposed to DS9, which seemed to have more of a, you know, this is where we think they are, and, you know, we hadn't cast the actors when we wrote these parts, and, you know, we're gonna play with it a little bit, and Cal Meany is going to be a big star from this thing. You know, they never said, okay, Ron Glass is going to be the big star, and we're going to focus on him because he's the one people know. And I think, although, you know, we were all very high on the DS9 pilot, I think, again, if you invested the effort into this one, that this is a superior pilot to that.
I think it's a different kind of pilot to that.
Absolutely.
They're working well within the Star Trek framework on Deep Space Nine.
And I think that's where I think the superiority comes, is they weren't bound by a formula in any way.
Mm. And I don't think the ensemble on Deep Space Nine gels as well in that pilot as they do in this. To me, this puts lie to that constant refrain that we hear from people. Oh, well, it takes a couple of seasons to get going. No, it doesn't. Here's your proof. 94 minutes. There you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Star Trek, I don't know whether it benefited or didn't benefit from the fact that they knew that it had the Star Trek franchise name behind it. So they kind of felt in that pilot episode for Deep Space Nine that they didn't have to have all their ducks in a row. They could allow things to expand over the course of a season or what to get these characters gelled together. I think Joss Whedon may have said, okay, we've got to get this thing right from the beginning, so I need to have all these characters' interactions and their motivations all set up from the beginning. And he did that, and it made for a really impressive pilot with this.
I think so too. Is that it? Have we exhausted it?
I don't know. Are we gonna give this rating like we do for the Listen to the Prophets? Or are we just gonna?
Well, I was listening to that. I was thinking about that, but I couldn't come up with anything. We've got gold-plated Latimer in Deep Space Nine. There doesn't really seem to be anything in Firefly we can give it ratings. We can't give it stakes like they do in Buffy.
Yeah.
Well, what was he paid? It was $200. They didn't say dollars, did they?
No.
It was something.
Was it platinum? I don't know. I'm trying to remember. Well, we can just rate it stars or, you know.
Oh, stop. I don't want to do stars.
All right, just
I'm going to throw a little trivia thing before we go to ratings. The character of Patience, portrayed by Bonnie Bartlett.
Yep.
Who is married to William Daniels.
Yay!
Oh, nice.
So we have our David Hasselhoff connection.
Angela just yelled through, we could give it dinosaurs.
That's not bad.
All right. Curse your inevitable betrayal.
Yeah.
What are we rating this out of five?
Good. Out of five, no, we haven't. Wait, you haven't talked about the Reavers. What did you think about the Reavers? Because at the moment, they're not much of anything, but they will become something more. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, by the time, you know, again, having seen this series and having seen the movie, the Reavers do become a major character or a major piece of the show. I like the fact that they have a sort of unnamed enemy. I enjoy the sort of almost mythical diabolical feel set up around them that, you know, if they catch us, they're going to rape us, skin us, and then eat us, hopefully in that order. I mean, that was – that really sells the idea that these are bad guys. I like the effects of them, you know, having to fly against – or, you know, the effects of them flying against this giant ship in the atmosphere and doing the controlled burn and knocking him out like that. That was really good. I think I may be a little hindered by the fact that I know where this is going. But I think the inclusion of the Reavers here at the beginning of the show is it gives for a good sort of scary bad villain for the beginning of the show, which I guess all science fiction shows eventually do need.
Yeah, I thought that they were presented as being frightening enough. And again, that line about, you know, hopefully they'll do it in that order, I think kind of sets that up very well. My apprehension is that they would turn out to be, you know, the Kazon or the DS9 version of the Ferengi. So,
well, I think it's benefited that we don't see anything of them. And, you know, it's left in our mind to kind of develop what these characters are like. And, you know, I'll spoil ahead a little. We'll get to see them eventually. And they do turn out to be as bad as they actually mentioned. So I don't think you'll be disappointed with them, but I like the setup initially that these are just crazed, insane people that are going to do horrible things if they ever catch the crew.
And I think in a Western type formula or setting, it is more easy to set them up as being just as bad as what they are. They're touted to be, because you're looking at, you know, certain areas that are a little lawless, and it allows them to have a lot of leeway in how they're presented. And that's another thing that jumps out at me, again, just comparing it to DS9, is we came along into DS9 saying it started out as basically, you know, the new sheriff coming into town with his son, kind of a little bit of a rifleman feeling to it and all of that. This is certainly a Western. My gut feeling is we're going almost for a Magnificent Seven type feeling, a group of disparate individuals with a moral compass that they try to hide to some extent, facing, you know, unbeatable odds. And that's my.
And the last time we got the Magnificent Seven in space, it was Battle Beyond the Stars, and I don't think that's a bad thing.
No, I don't think it's a bad thing either. I think it's a fairly good premise to go with.
Well, that was one of the things when you said you've not watched it, and knowing that one of my favorite films and one of your favorite films is The Outlaw Josie Wales, which has essentially the same premise. A Civil War guy who fought on the side that didn't win. And what does he do after that? Where does he go? What does he do? It's pretty much the same premise as The Outlaw Josie Wales. I would have been very surprised if you hadn't liked it at the very least, thought it was enjoyable.
Oh, no, there's no question I liked it. The difference between Outlaw Josie Wales is that focuses on the Outlaw Josie Wales, whereas this seems to be more of an ensemble type show. And I don't think that's a bad thing either, because Clint Eastwood can carry a 2-hour movie fairly easily, or at least he could at that point. You know, if The Outlaw Josie Wales was a TV series, I think it eventually would have become formulaic. So I think having an ensemble cast is a far better way to go with something like that. But there is definitely a little bit of that feel to it. And you know, it remains to be seen if Mal will turn out to be as tough as Josie Wales was. But so far, so good.
So the scene where he comes in at the end and just shoots what's in the head, shoots Dobson in the head.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of that?
Well, I mean, he seems to be a very layered character. You know, he does seem to be very three-dimensional. And I go back to that scene that I talked about with Jane, where he basically called him out at the beginning. And Jane backed down from him. And I think he has his own set of rules, and I don't think he's going to be cowed by anyone, including Dobson, who's, you know, basically the Alliance policeman there.
But also, in that situation, he has no choice. This guy's holding a gun on his crew. Reavers are coming. Mal obviously clearly weighs up the situation in his head and goes, right, I need to get rid of this guy as quickly and as efficiently as possible. Bang.
Yeah, and I think if circumstances were different, he wouldn't have made that choice.
That's what I mean.
He would have taken I'm sorry?
He's not a guy who goes in guns blazing unless he has no choice.
Exactly.
Now, some people have read that scene that Mal's a cold-blooded murderer, whereas I think, no, this guy's threatening his. They've got a clear and present danger coming up hot on their heels. He needs to resolve this situation quickly. And essentially what he does, though, is the way Jane would have handled it.
And it's a very pragmatic way of doing it. It wasn't that he intended to kill this person. It was like, I need to save my crew. This guy is causing a threat. I'm going to take this threat out as quickly as possible so I can save my crew.
And yeah, I always
completely
read it like
pragmatic.
That.
And but it also shows him to be a total badass.
Oh yeah, and why the controversy over that was, well, he's a bit of a murderer. No, he isn't. I didn't.
No,
read
no,
it
not
that
at all.
At all. I did love as well when they chuck him out the ship, Mal almost doesn't make it back through the doors.
I don't know
if that was intentional.
See, I would say he's not really a murderer, because if you go to the scene before that where he's getting shot at by Patience and all her goons, that he does not, once he shoots the horse and traps Patience underneath it, he could have easily just killed her and taken the money and run and taken the goods and run. But no, he doesn't. He said a deal was a deal. He took the money. He left her to dig her way out under the horse, and he was gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he left her to her little world.
Mm-hmm. Being pragmatic, he may need to do business with her again.
Mm-hmm. And
he's not a stupid man.
And you know, he knew if he were to take her out, that would just cause more problems. So he did the job despite the fact that she reneged on it. And he showed that he was the better man in the deal. So that was great.
Now, just from the negative point of view, you know how we've said, you know, having an unknown cast is a benefit to some extent because you don't have preconceived notions as to who these people are. Dobson was on an episode of Seinfeld where he was Ramon the pool boy who wanted to hang out with Jerry all the time. And sadly, as we were watching him, every time he was on screen, that kept coming to mind.
Thankfully, I haven't seen that episode of Seinfeld, so that didn't come into mind, thankfully.
I remember him from being on Buffy and Angel.
So that was the only negative as far as casting went for me. Whereas Ron Glass, who I've seen in countless episodes of Barney Miller, he was also in the remake of The Odd Couple. They did an all African-American version of The Odd Couple with him and Damond Wilson. And I remember that. But for whatever reason, in this particular role, I didn't have flashbacks to that.
Yeah, all right, well, the only other thing I've got is Fox originally refused to air this in widescreen. So even though Whedon shot it in widescreen. So there's one shot where he had to bring all the characters in a little bit so they'd fit on a 4x3 frame. And you can clearly see on the widescreen version that Wash isn't holding anything when he's supposed to be steering the ship, because they had to bring Alan Tudyk back a bit so he fitted in the 4x3.
Oh,
that's inadvertently hilarious when you spot it for the first time, that he's just sat there holding nothing at all.
See, I'm wondering, I'm assuming this is right at the advent of high-definition television sort of coming in, because I don't know exactly when that would. I know this came out prior to Enterprise, I think, which was one of the first shows that I remember actually being filmed, or at least one of the shows that I watched that was being filmed in HD. So, yeah, that the fact that they didn't show this in widescreen, yeah, that's disappointing, because I think this that gives it a more epic scale. It gives it more of a cinematic type feel if it's shot in the 16.9 rather than the 4x3. But
Okay, are we going to rate it with dinosaurs?
Sure.
Well done, Ange. We're going to rate it with dinosaurs.
All right, go ahead, Andy. This was your review.
We will call this episode This Land. I think you've got from what we've talked about. I think it's 5. I think it's a perfect pilot. I think it does everything a pilot should do. It tells a story. It introduces the characters. I watched it the other night with Ange, and I said after it finished watching it, damn, that was good. 10 years on, and I've watched it a couple of times, I think, because I've got it on DVD as well. I thought it was brilliant. So 5 shiny dinosaurs.
You know, I really enjoyed it, but I'm going to hold off on giving it a 5. I'm going to give it a 4.5 because, and I don't know how you can give half a die. I'll give it 4 T-Rexes and 1 Velociraptor, so that's a 4.5. Because it is a great, great introduction to the characters. The only niggling thing I had was they didn't allow River to be advanced in the same way the rest of the characters were, but the rest of the characters were so well done. You automatically know what the motivations behind these characters are. They're all so well fleshed out, and they all work together, and you can see the interactions between all of them, you know, the relationships between them and their feelings of disgust between each other and their feelings of love between each other. It's a really great show, but I think if I'm recalling, there might even be better shows than this. So I'm just going to go give it down a half step from what Andy did and give it a 4.5.
All right, it's time for the newcomer. How many Quatloos? As I'm thinking about it, I'm thinking more and more that this was kind of a cinematic experience. And I think that goes to what I was saying about having to really pay attention and not multitask as you're watching it. If you sat down in a movie theater and watched this pilot where all you had to do was look at the screen, unless you're one of these jerk-offs who sits on their phone in the movie theater, I think it would be a truly rewarding experience. And for that reason, I see it as cinematic as opposed to the scope of the cinematography or anything like that. I think the characters pay off. I think as long as you do watch it as you should watch it, it's a truly rewarding experience. It was an excellent show. It made me want to watch a lot more, and it made me sad in advance that there's so few episodes of this series. I think all of the characters have something going for them. I don't think there was one character that was introduced where I think that they're superfluous, with the exception of the way River was portrayed in this. But I have the benefit of hindsight of knowing that she will become a big star. So I know her character is going to become more significant as this goes on. So her lack of screen time really didn't bother me as I watched this. I think it's just an excellent show, and in the episodes that we have to come, in the movie that we have to come, my hope is that they will live up to the level of this as opposed to surpass it, because I'm not really sure as a TV episode that you can surpass it by very much. And even if you do make a better one, I think from a dinosaur point of view, I think I'm going to be content to say that it gets the same rating. So I'm giving this 5 Indominus Rexes, and I'm ready to roll with that.
Awesome.
Good.
So I hope you're not disappointed that I wasn't more bubbly about it, Andy.
No. I, when you said you hadn't seen it, I was very, very surprised if you didn't like it, knowing the kind of things that you do like.
Knowing how big I am on the new Fantastic Four movie and all.
Yeah, knowing that the new Fantastic Four, it won't be new by the time this comes out, so we've just dated it.
You know, by the time this comes out, this has already gone to DVD and Blu-ray and already failed there as well.
It's already in the discount bins.
Yeah, you can pick it up in $5. It's probably on a 3-pack with the first 2 Fantastic Four films for like $10 at Walmart. So go pick it up. It's worth it. No.
Obviously, no, this being the first one, we don't have any feedback, and I don't know that we will, given how we're recording these. So we just want to do it next time?
Sure, let's do it next time.
Next time on an all-new episode of Keep Flying, we're going to find out which one of us wasn't exactly burdened with an overabundance of schooling. It's the train job.
All right, well, looking forward to it. You know, despite my feelings on Joss Whedon, I can't say negative things about this show, so I'm looking forward to covering all this stuff. It's good to get a rewatch of this.
Well, I very much hope you enjoyed listening to that. As I said at the beginning of the show, the current plan is to try and get Paul, Dr. Bill and myself together to finish off doing Firefly. Whether that'll be on its own feed and a separate entity or part of somebody else's show, we've not made that decision yet. When I started editing this episode, I did think that the next two episodes that we recorded together, the next two are Firefly, The Train Job and Bushwhacked, I think, we thought that recording had been lost, as Paul didn't have one. And obviously we couldn't get it offshore. But Dr. Bill had a backup copy. So I will be editing those episodes and releasing them at some point. And then we will probably carry on our look at Firefly here on Two True Freaks. Stay tuned after the credits for some outtake stuff that we recorded just before we started talking about Firefly. The original raw audio for this episode was over 2.5 hours long, so that's how much we gab off. Obviously some of that stuff's private that we don't want for public consumption, but here's some discussion of films that were, well, relatively current at the time we recorded. Hope you enjoy them. As usual, for the Palace of Glitter and Delight, you can email me at heykidscomics@virginmedia.com. And if you want to drop by the Two True Freaks page and buy something through the Amazon link, we get a kickback, which is always nice, as it keeps the lights on and allows us to produce more content like this. Take care. Bye-bye.
So, we didn't get to talk about Ant-Man last time. What did you think about Ant-Man, Andy?
It was good. I enjoyed it.
Okay. There we go, done.
It was pithy.
Well, there's not really a lot. It was interesting in that it was a film about family. So going from the Avengers movie that are always global stakes to go to a film about fathers and daughters was good. Mm-hmm. And it was exceptionally well played by all concerned. And the ending was good, despite turning into Iron Man. But then the Thomas the Tank Engine bit was really funny. And it's not a top tier Marvel movie, but it didn't suck. And the fact that Marvel can do an Ant-Man movie and it made more money in what, its fifth or sixth week of release than Fox's new Fantastic Four movie just signifies Marvel know how to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I was surprised. I knew Edgar Wright had moved off the directing bit, but I didn't know that he and Joe Cornish kept on and basically wrote the screenplay. And you can tell that it's got an Edgar Wright and especially a Joe Cornish feel. I was kind of worried a lot of people would be, and you mentioned it in your Ant-Man review that you did with Hero, that you didn't think that the stereotypes of the sort of slapstick minority characters who were the sort of members of the Ocean's 11 group for Paul Rudd wouldn't maintain throughout history, that maybe if we look back on this in a couple of years we may feel this is kind of dated or not as humorous as it is now. I think it actually worked really well in the same way that the characters in Attack the Block sort of work. Joe Cornish wrote these characters as being of their own sort of ethnic stereotypes, but shaking the round enough that they were entertaining. If you've ever seen Attack, I know you've seen Attack the Block, Andy.
I love Attack the Block.
The kids in there, when you see them, you think these are going to be thugs. These are going to be the antagonists of the film. And you get this kind of, there's this sense of from those characters that they're going to be rude, unruly kids, but in the end they come out being the heroes, but they're not, I guess they're not redeemed from being those characters. They're still the same characters. They're just showing a heroic side and not glossing over the fact that they come from this sort of downtrodden, I'm not thinking right. It's too early, but I think they characterize the characters really well, and I give credit to Edgar Wright and Joe Cornish for doing that in the movie.
Yeah, I've been championing for quite a long time that Marvel shouldn't put all its chips on the table every time, and I think they've built so much goodwill that I don't think they are anymore, even with their huge budget films, and. It's interesting, you hear some of the, Hollywood finance issues. I think, Andy, I think you and I had this conversation where it's actually more problematic for them to try and make a low budget movie than it is a higher budget movie.
Yeah, apparently it's harder to make your money back on a medium budget film by the time, because you factor in, well, the film may only be medium budget, but then we don't really have the money for extensive advertising. So it's harder to make your money back apparently on a $50 million, which is now considered low budget movie, than a $100 million budget movie. So, right. Which is a shame, which is perhaps why they've gone down the Netflix route. Because
I hadn't even thought of that.
They are essentially low-budget movies. Daredevil, I mean, I don't know that they're all going to follow that paradigm, but Daredevil was a 13-hour film. That wasn't episodic television. That was a 13-hour film.
Yeah, and it's interesting how well that the Daredevil series held together, considering that it was directed pretty much every section of the 13-hour film was directed by a separate director. I think there was one guy who did the pilot, and I think he may have done the finale as well, but they had different writers throughout the series. They had different directors, and it didn't in any way feel disjointed. There was a complete cohesive narrative throughout all of it. And the fact that they had multiple people working on it and multiple directors trying to get the characters to portray these people in the right way, that it felt so that it didn't veer off and it didn't diverge and break off in any way was, I think, a testament to the showrunners, whoever they are for that. I can't remember their names.
Well, especially seeing as the showrunner changed two episodes in. The first two episodes were written by Drew Goddard, and he was supposed to be the showrunner for the series. And he got the offer to go to work with Sony, and I bet he's kicking himself now, and write and direct the Sinister Six film that was supposed to follow Spider-Man 2. And at the last minute, I can't remember his name, but I can see his face. The guy who did Spartacus came in and show ran it from that point. So the fact that you had two showrunners, one of which came in at the last minute, the fact that that came together as remarkable as it did is, I think, a testament to the Marvel method. And there's been a lot of people moaning that Marvel stamp their vision on what the film should be. And I'm sat reading these criticisms going, well, what's the problem with that? Isn't letting everyone have their version of the characters what's ruining the comics? Isn't it better that one person sits there going, no, this is what I want these to be. And if you can work within that framework, fine, we'll have no problems. But if you can't, no harm, no foul, there's the door.
Well, I think that they're sticking to a set idea of what the characters will be or what the characters should be in these films, but they're allowing different ways or different types of films to be made. You know, Guardians of the Galaxy was a space opera romp. Ant-Man was a very personal family type film. You've got Captain America Winter Soldier, which was essentially sort of a Cold War spy film on the lines of, you know, The Manchurian Candidate or 3 Days of the Condor. So you've got this set direction of how these characters should act, but you've got Marvel who allow these vastly different film directors, like getting Kenneth Branagh for Thor, having Edgar Wright work on the Ant-Man thing. You know, yes, Peyton Reed came in to direct the movie, but I don't think you can look at that film and not see some stamp of Edgar Wright on that film, which is why I found it really enjoyable, because I've yet to see anything from Edgar Wright that I haven't at least really enjoyed and in the most out and out loved. So the Marvel Studios as a whole, I think by having that sort of idea of keeping it sort of rigid and having a sort of set design for their characters is doing a lot better job than letting whatever director, Josh Trank, come in and do whatever he wants to do with the film. And then ultimately...
Yeah, and even arguably Christopher Nolan.
Mm-hmm.
With what he did with Batman. Now, I don't really have a problem with a lot of Nolan's Bat films, except the third one, which is just a bad film. Yeah. But at the end of that film, he ends the story. And as a Warner Brothers executive, would you not be sat there going, all right, this is great, where do we go from here? Well, we don't want this to be the end of our Batman movies.
It's the Planet of the Apes syndrome, where each movie they were asked for a sequel, and they said, I don't know, where do we go from here?
We just blew up the Earth. What do we do now? Mm-hmm. But in that instance, though, in each time, they cleverly came up with a way to carry the series on. Rebooting is just lazy, but... And we don't even really know if this Batman's going to be a reboot, to be honest. We don't know anything yet.
I suspect it is neither going to be a continuation nor a reboot.
I don't.
It's just going to be Batman exists in this universe. End of story.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's right. I mean, Affleck said they're playing him in his mid-40s in Empire this month. So it's possible that it's a Batman who has retired and is coming back, which would fit in with the whole Dark Knight Returns thing that we seem to be keep seeing. But we can't really judge the DC stuff because of this cross universe thing that they're building. We've only seen Man of Steel. I don't think you can count Nolan's films in what DC are planning to do.
Not unless somehow Batman v Superman, you know, or Superman v Batman. I don't even know which way they put it anymore. But unless that directly ties into the Nolan film somehow, which would surprise me.
I'd be quite surprised by that as well. I think we're just assuming at this point that those three just exist on their own and they're not going to be part of this. Because it doesn't even seem like Green Lantern's going to be part of it anymore.
No, but, I think sadly, I think they're going to want to distance themselves as much as they can from the 2009 Green Lantern, which is understandable but disappointing. Yeah.
Well, but just to kind of backtrack a little bit when I started to talk about budget. I mean, Ant-Man didn't have a low budget, but it is definitely a smaller film coming off on the heels of The Age of Ultron. And I think Marvel is well served by doing that. I think if they just keep trying to top themselves with every movie, they're going to fall into the problems that some of the Bond movies had, where they start getting into, or even the Tim Burton Batman movies, where they just try to keep topping themselves and they stop worrying about story so much.
They just start going for spectacle.
Exactly. And I think reeling it back a little bit, which is what I think they did in this, but still, you know, going for quality, putting quality over spectacle. I think that's the way to go, and I think they've done that. And I think this is definitely a very enjoyable movie. And as Sean pointed out, I do have some questions about how much legs it has over time, because some of the humor just seems like it might get tiresome. And I don't even know if that's the case. You know, it was very amusing through one watch, but I just don't know if it's. I often point to the fact that I cringe watching Ned Beatty in the. In Superman, and I'm afraid it's going to have that kind of factor to it.
Well, I can see that because it is very much of the time. It is that sort of very hip, trendy Latino, sort of aspect to the film.
It's a combination of a little bit of that with a little bit of over the top. Because that was the thing about Ned Beatty, is he's just a little too over the top with the, oh, Mr. Luthor. You know, it just, like I said, it just.
Yeah, well, I can't disagree with you. I think these characters in the Ant-Man film were a little more subtle than Ned Beatty was. But I do see that their characters
is like
are.
He took a stick with a nail in it and hit you in the head.
Yes, these guys are just poking you with the stick. They're not hitting you with it. You know, it is very much the stereotype of these cultures, but it's not so egregious that it's not like a Madea movie. It's not like, you know, where it's ridiculous over the top star or a Friday movie or a Kid and Play movie. It's not where the stereotypes are just so broad that it's obnoxious. They are the stereotypes of the time, but I don't think that they could be considered in the future to be somewhat not really offensive, but just irritating, but I can't see them. I can't see them to the extent as I would the Ned Beatty from the Superman movie. At least, and that's just me, though.
Yeah, I mean, I could be, my criticism could be way over the top on it itself. I may be overreacting to it a little bit because they were not the centerpiece of the movie by any stretch. So, you know, where I'm pointing to this saying it may be annoying, even if I turn out to be right, it might be such a minor annoyance that it doesn't really affect things.
Yeah. Well, I think the movie was serviced really well by Michael Douglas's portrayal. I thought, you know, I expected really nothing from Michael Douglas. And for me, he stole the movie. I was just overwhelmed with him. And I didn't even know, you know, I thought that they did a sort of, what is it, Jeff Bridges from Tron CG over him for the opening scene. And when I heard that, you know, that was just a sort of a stunt double working for him, that was phenomenal. That was some of the best, you know, makeup effects or whatever digital rendering over his face to make it look like the young sort of 1980s Wall Street Michael Douglas. That was just impressive.
Yeah, as I said when we did our review show on it, very very much like what I thought of the recreation of Arnold Schwarzenegger in the new Terminator movie. And I don't know if either of you have seen that.
Not yet.
No.
Because I don't want to spoil anything, so I'll try and keep this very vague. But there's a scene in the new Terminator movie where they go back to the Arnold introduction scene in the first Terminator movie. And apparently they didn't use any old footage. What they did was they recreated the scene with a body double, and they used all CGI technology to turn him into 1984 Arnold Schwarzenegger. And it's pretty much seamless. I think it's an incredible, you know, incredible special effect. And I think, you know, seeing what they did to de-age Michael Douglas, because apparently that was also a body double, it boggles my mind. It's amazing what they can do.
See, because the last time I really saw that, like I said, saw that used for a major film was the Tron Legacy movie. And even it looked kind of off, but because it was set in a computer world, you could kind of let that go, saying that that was just an effect of the computer world of you seeing that there. When he was out, you know, like in Tron, when he was out as the young Flynn in the real world, that looked awkward and out of place. But when he was in the computer world, when he was in Tron world, I think it worked okay. But I liked it.
I have to confess, I didn't see Tron Legacy. I heard enough negative things that I decided, okay, I'm not going to watch it.
It for me, it fell short because it looked too real. Maybe that's just me thinking there was such a distinct difference between what was real and what was CGI in the original Tron, that the fact that they made it try and look so real in the computerized generated world that it took something away from it. I would have liked it if it had a bit of that sort of pixelated look, but I guess it's, you know, the advancement of computers and things are supposed to look more real. That just sort of took me out of the feel of the movie. But
I didn't mind Tron Legacy. It's all right.
Yeah, it was, you know, it wasn't bad, but, you know, I can see why people who were fans of the original Tron could have found this to be a lesser movie.
See, I liked the original Tron, but I wasn't a devotee of it. You know, I mean, like, I know Scott loves the original Tron.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's because I'm a few years older, and maybe it had a different impact on me because of that. I'm not sure, but, you know, I thought it was good, and then I moved on. Whereas to him, that was a classic. I don't know where you guys fall on that one.
Yeah, I saw it as a kid and thought it was all right. I always preferred The Last Starfighter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd probably have to go with that. I'd probably have to go with you. I enjoyed The Last Starfighter as well. I thought it was a better story. I thought Tron was inventive. I liked the computer graphics and the idea of this world inside the computer. But I thought the last Starfighter was a better story and had more interesting characters in it. So,
yeah, of the two computer-generated movies from that era, that was always my favorite. I didn't not like Tron. I just don't think – I didn't watch it anywhere near as much as I watched The Last Starfighter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the thing. I don't mean to blast Tron because I did like it. It's just, you know, I didn't find it to be as innovative as I think they were hoping it to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, you know, at that time I was in on the, you know, whatever, the Atari – I guess it was before the 2600, maybe even. I don't even remember what version. Actually, I'm getting confused because that's the Nintendo, whatever. But I had the Atari game platform, and they came out with the, you know, the Tron games for it, and I thought, oh, this is going to be cool. And they were kind of lackluster, I thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, looking back at the Atari 2600, the one with the joystick with the red button, a lot of those games were just awful. I mean,
see, my main take on that is I remember an episode of Knight Rider where they controlled Kit with one of those joysticks. Brilliant.
Because that's all you needed was the joystick and one button. Yeah,
the red button was turbo boost. It's a brilliant episode. Of course it was.
Brakes were non-existent on that particular.
Oh, no, they didn't have brakes.
You pull backwards for the brakes and you push.
Yeah. They would yank it to the corner to get it to do one of those U-turns in the middle of the road. It was one. I don't remember the exact plot, but somebody hacked into Kit's CPU so they could control him with the joystick. It was brilliant.
I'll take your word for
that one. I'm brilliant. By brilliant, I mean, you know, it was brilliant for Knight Rider.
Which, you know.
It was brilliant in a David Hasselhoff kind of way.
Yep.
But isn't everything that David Hasselhoff does brilliant?
You know, I really feel like I need to watch his Nick Fury movie again because I haven't seen it in years.
Do you know what? I've got it on DVD. I found it in the cheap bin in HMV and I bought it and I watched it. He's not the problem with it. I will go on record and say that right now. He is doing his very best Charlton Heston impression, which is what you want from Nick Fury.
Mm-hmm.
And he tries, God bless him, he tries his best throughout that entire pilot. The problem is that David Goyer's script is cliched as hell. The other actors in it aren't terribly good, and it runs out of steam before it gets to the end, an ending that it can't afford because of its budget. But bless him, he's doing his best.
Wait. David Goyer wrote a script with cliches in it?
Yeah, I know that you're stunned by that revelation.
Get out.
Please.
But, you know, I think a lot of people take my what I say about that is David Hasselhoff is the best thing in it as a condemnation. But it actually isn't. I've got a lot of respect for David Hasselhoff. Anyone who can turn his career into a positive is all right in my book.
All right.
He's even
what,
doing
what he did reality, with Baywatch.
Yeah. There's a reality TV show on here at the minute called Hoff the Record, which is him just sending himself up mercilessly.
Oh, my Lord.
The premise of it is his career's gone down the toilet in America, so he's come over here, and he's just sending himself up. We see him do pantomime. We see him auditioning for a film about the life of David Hasselhoff, and he doesn't get the job. And it's not a great show. I kind of drifted off after two or three episodes, but the fact that he's willing to send himself up like that says something about him.
Is it a sort of reality show?
It's the closest thing I can say. It's like The Office. He's playing a version of himself.
Okay, so it's a takeoff on a reality show, but it's...
Yeah.
So yeah, what's the one that was on HBO with Warwick Davis?
Oh, Extra.
Not extras.
It's like that. Yeah, essentially.
Was it episodes? No, episodes was on Showtime.
It's like something like A Little Life or something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
But that's what it sounds like, which was actually, I don't know about the David Hasselhoff one, but that one was the, you know, the real cringeworthy humor where you're laughing because he's in such incredibly uncomfortable situations.
It's Ricky Gervais.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's the humor that Rick, like you said, from The Office. So Ricky Gervais has kind of created that whole new genre of comedy.
Yeah. So, you know, the fact that he's willing to send himself up. But it's worth watching the Nick Fury thing just to see what could have been.
Speaking of that, can you imagine? Targeted to Star Trek, I just love, I crack up every time I see the Patrick Stewart scene on Extras with Ricky Gervais.
I've not seen that. I'm kind of looking into this, blunt talk thing that Patrick Stewart is supposed to be doing where he's a talk show host.
Oh, that's on Encore or Stars?
That's on Encore or Stars. It looks interesting. However, you know, it's supposedly, you know, created and written or whatever by what's his name from Family Guy. I can't remember his name.
Oh, Seth.
Yeah, Seth MacFarlane.
That's the one.
Yeah. So,
Well, I would, after we're done, I would strongly recommend that you go onto YouTube and just look up Patrick Stewart on Extras.
See, I remember him on. No, that may be the one. I know he was on one of those. Yeah, that's the one that I've seen. So I'll go check that out. I think I may have seen that one, but it's been a while.
Just in case you haven't, I'm not going to say anything about what it's about because I find it to be very amusing.
It is. It's very funny.
Anyway, having brought the room to a dead stop.
No, you haven't. That was fun.
So what are we doing?
That's as little as possible, one would imagine.